Are you going to stand in the back again? We probably wouldn't have known this if I hadn't told you about it, but man, I thought I lost like a whole page of my class notes. Not your class notes, my notes, because I thought, what in the world? What I did was I turned and two pages stuck together. But we're okay. Because I knew there was something I wanted to talk about. I thought, where is it? It's gone. And then I found it. So you probably would never known it. Yeah. I'm going to have to break down and get some glasses. All right. Well, you should have your Bibles open at Romans chapter 12, verse 8. And we're looking at the next to the last issue in the verse, the in the area of the three offices that you will be determining how you're going to labor with your Father in this local assembly. The middle one or the second one is the issue of ruling, and to just get all three of them. Paul once again says, "He that giveth, let him do it with simplicity. He that ruleth with diligence, he that showeth mercy with cheerfulness." All of you know we're in that laboring aspect now for the first time with our Father. And we look around and see that there's practical needs that the assembly has, bringing that body analogy to bear on everything that we do, governing our thoughts and everything. We now know that there's ruling aspects to the body that give orderliness to it. Our members function in those offices from time to time. Not that they function in it all the time. Some do. And there's some analogies you can give in association with that. I just didn't try to exhaust all the analogies. But to give orderliness to the body, orderliness to the local assembly is what the operation is all about that stands behind the ruling. And to actually give, and where it actually touches the body, is to regulate, to manage the affairs of the body. And therefore, there are practical areas other than the edificational areas where the bishop or the deacon are concerned, where you as a member of the body can manage, can regulate, can produce orderliness to the body. And that's what stands behind the ruling office. But now we're looking at its functionality, and God comes along and says, "He that ruleth, do it to do it with diligence." And we talked about that just a little bit, and now what I want to do is ask you to participate a little bit. When you think about diligence, and we talked that diligence, we'll look at it again a little later on, it does have, just as simplicity has its counterpart, diligence also does. What does it mean to rule when it says with diligence? What is diligence?
Activity you put your mind to.
Okay.
It's as important to think about what you're doing all the way to the end as it is the activity that you're doing.
Good. Yeah, that's good. I appreciate that. That's certainly in there, huh? Stick to it, right. That's more of a colloquial expression, but it's on the mark. I know you've got a bunch of stuff. We were talking about old Daniel Webster, or Noah, I guess it would be, Webster's 1828. Yeah, he packed a bunch of stuff in that. The fact that, yeah. Carefulness to details. Yeah, that's on the mark. Right. Focus and follow through.
I was going to say not easily distracted, but
that's kind of. Yeah. That's what you want in your students, right? You want diligent students. Not easily distracted. Webster brought out the fact that I believe the French and Latin roots of diligence really has to do with love, and setting your mind to a task. It's having that singleness of mind to get a job accomplished. And another great thing about the definition that Webster gives, he slips in there some of the carnal counterparts to it, like sloth and idleness. And I will say I had to look up the word, what was it, assiduous?
Assiduous.
Yeah, I had to, that was one that I've heard the word, but my vocabulary didn't quite. I always like that. I'm looking up a word to define it, and then I'm having to look up the words that define it. Anyone else? Those are all good. I mean, and they're right on the mark. It's a word that we're familiar with. We have some familiarity with doing something diligently or looking at someone and saying they're diligent in what they're doing. But some of the things, for instance, from the OED, the Oxford English Dictionary, it means the constant and earnest effort to accomplish what is undertaken. And that's what your ruling has to be. It has to be that constant, that earnestness of effort to accomplish what is undertaken. Steady in applying oneself to the business at hand. Somebody mentioned giving attention, giving due attention. That's a big part of diligence. You give it your attention. Sometimes we talk about your undivided attention, but it's due attention. It's the exertion of body or mind without unnecessary delay or sloth. That comes right from Webster. It's that exertion of body or mind without unnecessary delay or sloth. Just simply talking about taking care to do something, earnestly caring for something. Interestingly enough, and this is one I found over in the OED, and I'm just going to mention this because it fits with ruling with diligence and it fits so well in the body concept and especially in sonship labor and the sonship edification. Diligence. And you have to look a little harder to find this, but you will find it in the definition of diligence. But diligence also has in mind a persistent endeavor to please. A persistent endeavor to please. And isn't that what you as a son want to do? In fact, you as one who is our members of a body and members one of another, you want to, isn't one of the body attributes you have that of a servant? And one of the things that you do in your ruling capacity, even when you order your own body, whether it's your physical hygiene or appearance, or in some of the systems inside your body that bring order to your body, the whole issue is to serve and to please and to give pleasure and to the one whom you are serving. And that's really, I think, a fascinating aspect of diligence, that it has in mind the persistent, you're not just somebody, like I said, when the father or your superior would come and check your work to see that it was done in due diligence and done the way God wants it to be done and what be acceptable unto him. The labor office function of ruling with diligence is really in that persistent endeavor to please. And just though as with, and I think, I don't think we need to do hardly anything else in touching on that, because we've got a good appreciation of that, and I think you've got a healthy understanding of how even those basic definitions can all be brought to bear under the godly selfless love and the body attributes, and what emerges is that kind of diligence, that we're not just talking about diligence any old way, but diligence that has to do with us as a body and one body in Christ. Well, just as is true with all three of the descriptions of functionality that you have here, simplicity, diligence, and cheerfulness, where the offices of practical need are concerned, the word diligence of all of these, the diligence is specially chosen to make an impression. He that ruleth with diligence. That one, by the way, that's well, I'm not even going to get into that. But even the way in which it sounds in the English, simplicity, cheerfulness, but diligence. Diligence kind of stands out as having a little bit of oomph to it, of power to it. And it does. It's one of those D words. It's diligence. And that has to make an impression, and it needs to make a sufficient enough impact upon a son who chooses to function in the office of ruling. And I want to talk for a moment about that impact, that your ruling isn't just done, you know, it's like, sometimes it's like pulling teeth, they say, to get people to do things in an assembly. It used to be the worst job you could possibly have in any church is the Sunday school superintendent job. It was the most hated job in the world because you had to get people to fill in and you had to get people to teach. It was like, you hear that expression, it's like pulling teeth to get nursery duty back here. We even used to call it that blankety blank kid duty and whatever. But it was just, but that's not the way your body works. Your body doesn't come along and be slothful and in seeing to its appearance or seeing to some ruling or orderly capacity that needs to get done. But there's an impact that needs to be made upon us as sons, thinking about this the way our Father wants us to think about it. And that impact is actually found not just so much in the defining of the word diligence, but in the various shades of meaning that the word diligence carries. And that can be found, for instance, in an excellent work that was written by a reverend, a minister by the name of Charles Smith, in a book called Synonyms Discriminated. And I'm going to put this on the board. You don't need to write it down if you don't want to or any of those things. It's kind of lengthy. But I do want to go over it because it shows you the kind of impact that this word is designed to have. And it really gets across to you that as a son, that desire to please by my diligent attending to the orderliness of the assembly is something that I ever want to do because it's needful and meets a practical need of the body. And this is what he said. And I'm going to go through this kind of slowly. I put it up there so you could all read it. But just follow along with this for a moment. This is Charles Smith. He says, "The diligent man is he who gives sustained attention to any matter which admits of perseverance and interest." By the way, when you go back into the 1800s, you're starting to get back into people who knew how to write, how to talk, how to think in English, which we don't today. People today, they don't know. I even heard that, believe it or not, folks, those of us who came through the system, I guess the public school system has now officially given up on cursive writing. Is that right? It's unbelievable. They don't even teach you to write cursively anymore. They've given up on it. Well, the way my handwriting was, I figured I might have provided that final nail in the coffin, but I had to do it. If you want to see my cursive writing, you ought to see my Social Security card. I think I signed it when I was like 10. I had just learned to write in cursive. But the truth of the matter is, when you get back to this period of time, Charles Smith really says that so well, even in that first statement. The diligent man is he who gives sustained attention, not just glancing at it, not just give it, but sustained attention to any matter which admits of perseverance and interest. And by the way, there shouldn't be a single matter that your body is not interested in. And there's certain things that demand its perseverance and its interest. He goes on to say in the next sentence, he says, it denotes a specific pursuit. That's why we spent time on the issue of ruling, so that you understand and appreciate the matters that ruling demand a particular kind of orderliness and management and overseeing and that kind of thing within the local assembly, because it denotes a specific pursuit. It's not just haphazard or hit and miss, but there's a specific focused pursuit. He goes on to say, diligence signifies the attention we pay to any particular object out of preference to others. That's very well put. Diligence is the attention we pay to any particular object out of preference to others. And there's where our godly selfless love comes in. Godly selfless love comes in and says, I'm going to esteem this, I'm going to prefer this and not this. That's why, folks, you can't just come along, walk into the assembly, hear a couple of Bible classes and say, I'll do this, I'll do that. That's not the way this is to be done. You have to have some thoughtful, intelligent sonship approach to this, as well as some intelligent sonship prayer with your Father, to think about what you're going to be suited for, or what someone else would be better suited for, to meet the needs of the local assembly. But diligence signifies the attention we pay to any particular object out of preference to others. And I tried to, the next one I tried to put in bold, but it didn't come out too well on the board. But this is so critical. He says, diligence, look at this, is a combination of activity and order. Diligence is a combination of activity and order. After all, your diligence is going to be in the very field of order. Your diligence here is going to be in the very field of ruling and providing order. That's one of the ways that you can kind of check your work and make sure you can look and see that we do have our finger right on the pulse of the operation of our Father that stands behind our ruling and our maintaining, our regulating and management. Diligence is a combination of activity and order. He goes on to say, the diligent man does not lose a moment. I love this. The diligent man does not lose a moment, but employs and fills up all his time. That's a diligent individual. They don't lose a moment. For us, what are we doing with time? Redeeming it. We're buying it. We're purchasing it. There's no other human being on this earth that can do that, that can actually purchase time, than a son. By the way, that's not done by just your average Christian. A son redeems the time. Christians, what is the only other expression you call the way you use time? Well, I guess it's not the only other. The opposite of redeeming the time, spending it. Huh? I'm spending, 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 spending. A son is to be redeeming the time. That's a fascinating issue to me, and one that I'm gaining far more clarity on than I ever had before, of what that means. But the diligent man does not lose a moment, but employs and fills up all his time. But I love this last sentence of what Smith talks about here. He says this, it is the indispensable requisite of all ordinary success, that is, diligence is the indispensable requisite of all ordinary success, especially because, watch this at the end of it, especially because to the diligent man, work is not irksome. Work is not irksome. I love that. To the diligent man, work is not irksome. No, you're laboring with your Father. You're ruling with diligence. And therefore, this functional expression wraps up so much meaning because a great impact has been made upon you. The impact was made upon you up in verse 3 when you understood what godly love was and what he values and esteems as he has dealt to every man the measure of faith. And that impact comes from understanding yourself as a body with all these body attributes of conduct and behavior. And coming out of that is this great desire to put your hands to work, to put your mind to work, to begin to labor with your Father. And then when you look around and you realize what is available to you in the assembly of the body to do, you have giving that can be done with simplicity. You have ruling that can be done. And it's not a small matter. It may look small in comparison to other churches. We don't have a lot of things. But there's no small thing in your body, really. Even on a microscopic level, some of the smallest parts of your body are some of the most important when it comes to ordering it and regulating it and managing it. Even down to the cellular level that allows for its regulation. Your body has a temperature that has to be regulated. And certain things will click in when demands are made upon it and when it needs to be brought back into order. When you get too hot, your body calls upon certain things to happen so that perspiration is produced and you have an automatic air conditioning system that kicks in that your body was created with. That's just one example of how the members of your body actually function, and it doesn't come along and say, well, I'll wait until you get up to about 104, 105. No, it kicks in immediately when the demand is there. And there's nothing irksome about it. It sits there, it operates, like I said in our last lesson, several lessons ago. It may operate in the background, but it is nonetheless important. It may not be the eyes or the nose or the mouth or some of those things, but it is incredibly important. And a son never finds that kind of an operation with his father to be work that is irksome to him. But it is something that he is going to diligently pursue. I think what Smith said there is just so wonderfully put and fits so perfectly with sonship edification, and as far as I'm concerned with our appreciation of diligence, ruling with diligence. But anyway, when you have this functional expression of the office of ruling, that being ruling with diligence, diligence perfectly suits the office of ruling and the operation of God that stands behind it. Local church orderliness, to give orderliness to the body. And it also perfectly suits a son's heart with the effectual working, when he's got that effectual working of his sonship orientation, his sonship establishment. I mean, think of this if you've just freshly come out of Romans 8 and 9 and 10 and 11. You've got that fresh understanding of your sonship establishment, and you've just come through verses 1 and 2 and then 3, 4, and 5 of chapter 12, and that great desire is now there. And that desire that came all the way back from my sonship orientation and sonship establishment that I want to do with my Father more than anything else. Really, one of the things I learned on the very first day that I learned I was adopted as His son. My desire is to please Him. That's why you have repeatedly over there in the book of Proverbs that a wise son pleases his father. And what it means for a father to be well pleased in his son. But that's been your desire all along. And that's why the labor aspect of this should be just a threat. This should be fantastic. That's what he's been looking at doing with him all along. Is laboring within in his business, especially as his father begins to labor with you as a son in his business of what he's doing in the local assembly. Well, with that additional effectual working of the godly selfless love plus the body attributes of conduct and behavior, the son's ruling will be the natural result of that effectual working. His labor will be characterized by his sustained attention to his specific pursuit, ruling within the body of the local assembly with the view to order that ruling of labor begins to create and begins to bring to bear upon the assembly. And his ruling, your ruling in this local assembly should never be characterized, a son's ruling will never be characterized by viewing his labor with his father as anything such as irksome, or him being weary, the son's weary with it, or annoyed by it, or tedious to him, or anything along those lines. That's that counterpart, that carnal counterpart of diligence. You've got people in some churches, they'll do things, but that's always looked upon as, oh, that's wearisome or annoying or tedious or something along those lines. Again, this is a son seeing through a different set of eyes. He sees the value in this, the training in this, the preparation that he's going through in this for function in the creature. And therefore, just as we said before, the only way functioning in the office of giving is to be acceptable to your Father is to do it with simplicity. The only way ruling is going to be acceptable to him is to do it with diligence. And so when we think of that and we think of diligence, I mentioned just a moment ago its counterpart. All of us have had some experience with some boss that we looked at. That boss is ruling over us. He's in a ruling capacity. And we just can't stand the guy. Because the truth of the matter is, most people don't like their boss. Wasn't there just a movie out about killing your boss or something like that? And that's because most bosses are viewed, if it's true or not, as usually lazy, good for nothing, unfair, overbearing. They give me too much work to do, pay me too little money, or whatever. You can fill in the blank, whether it's real or whether it's imagined. But my point in bringing this up to you in connection with ruling with diligence is just to point out the fact that the natural fleshly response, when you're talking about ruling, you're talking about being in a position of authority. And the normal, natural, carnal response to authority is to abuse it. And that's one of the reasons people hate their bosses. Because oftentimes you do have a boss who abuses their authority. I'm not getting into the right or wrongness of it. I'm just trying to tell you what comes along with this sometimes as a counterpart to godly ruling with diligence. And the natural, fleshly, carnal response to most bosses' authority is usually some kind of loathsome reluctance, irksomeness to do oftentimes just enough to get by. I actually heard somebody say this once. This is back in the days when minimum wage was like 4 1/4 or something like that. And I had a friend who said, I'm being paid 4 1/4 and I'm only going to give them 4 1/4. And I got promoted and he was still getting 4 1/4. But that's oftentimes what you find, especially now in our culture that is far now more expecting something for nothing than a generation ago. And each generation that goes by, it gets worse that way, where you have an entitlement mentality that I'm entitled to this because I'm a human being, I'm entitled to this because of my color, I'm entitled to this because I'm fat or thin, I'm entitled to this because I'm bald or have hair, I'm entitled to, for the whatever reason there is, but there's this entitlement mentality. Well, that's not sonship labor. Sonship labor is done wholeheartedly. That's what a son does. He rules with diligence. His whole heart is involved. In fact, with simplicity, with diligence, with cheerfulness, your whole heart is involved, especially when you labor with your Father in the office of ruling in the local assembly. But now you're now the one that are going to be ruling. You're going to be the one that has the privilege of being in a position of authority, the one ruling, and you do so wholeheartedly. You do so without abusing that authority. And you do so, as it says here, with diligence, godly diligence, as one with godly selfless love. You do so consistent with looking at one another, and anyone who you may be managing or may be regulating with that godly selfless love, with the recognition that they've been dealt the same measure of faith, with the recognition that they're useful, that you cooperate and serve them to the welfare of the whole body. And so therefore, You do so as one who is consistent with being one body in Christ, and every one members one of another. That's why I keep pushing that living union dynamic. And so you have a couple of offices to think about by now. You have, and to apply godly, selfless love, the body attributes of conduct and behavior to. You have a couple of offices to talk to your father about and some intelligent, sonship prayer. And then, if I've done my job right, I've come up to the point of telling you what to do, and you have to sit down and figure out all on your own to choose to function in one of these offices and meet the practical needs of the assembly. Some are immediate right now. Some won't come up until we have need later on for it. And then you're going to have to go about figuring out exactly what needs to get done and what your role in that is going to be. And by the way, what I just said to you there in the last 2 minutes, that shouldn't be ominous to you. That shouldn't be scary. That should thrill you. You should be thrilled. I'm not trying to criticize anybody because nobody said this, but I wouldn't have been surprised if I didn't have people come up to me sometime during the last couple of Bible classes and even warn me, whatever you do, don't tell me what to do. Don't step on my ground. My ground is the ground of liberty as a son to figure things out on my own and have the freedom to choose those things on my own. I'm not under the law. I'm not under a tutor or a governor. That should be the thrill. By the way, let me just throw this in as well to make you a little more thrilled about it. There's absolutely nothing wrong. And by the way, there's nothing even remotely sinful that when you're in the process of going through choosing something that you're going to do that could come under the category of ruling or under the office of giving, there's nothing wrong nor sinful with choosing something that you enjoy doing. Or choosing something that makes you happy doing. In other words, there's absolutely nothing godly in self-mutilation. in choosing the worst thing that you hate just so that you can, that there's some kind of morbid, macabre, godly approbation that is achieved by you suffering through the something that you absolutely hate to do. In other words, what I call, I don't know if it's right to call it that, but self-mutilation type work, a la Opus Dei. If you know what I'm talking about. Opus Dei of Roman Catholicism? No? I'm getting tilt. If you're cartoon figures, you had little X's on your eyes. Where they read some scripture and then they flog themselves till they bleed and all that. Oh, never mind. You don't need to know. But there's no godly benefit in that kind of junk. So think about what you would delight in doing, and that's, there's nothing wrong in that. Well, anyway. That it's such a thrill to be able to finally make some decisions on your own and exercise that sonship liberty to give with simplicity, to rule with diligence. Well, that takes us then to the final one up here. Verse 8, he that giveth once again, let him do it with simplicity. He that ruleth with diligence, he that showeth mercy with cheerfulness. And I've yet to tell you why you have these. Well, I've told you somewhat of why you have these three. They are the three most practical needs, but why are they in that order? And I've been letting you chew on that some, and if I don't get it, remind me, and I'll get it when we get to the end of all this. But I don't expect you to really get it until we get to the end of it. So the third major office of practical need that every local assembly has is the office of showing mercy. By the way, if I were to put a 3x5 card on those and cover those up, I'm not sure if I would have come up with these three exactly or not, but I would. You would come up with something similar to them. Maybe not call them this, but these are the three that are the most practical needs that everybody has. And I don't mean just everybody. I mean your physical body has these three practical areas of need. It needs giving, it needs ruling, and it needs showing mercy. And this is the third area of practical need that, because we are a body and a local assembly, every local assembly has need of showing mercy. And just to real quickly do the approach, we're going to handle this office just like we've handled the previous two. And that's by bringing the body analogy of verses 4 and 5 to bear upon it. Because we haven't left the contextual setting, that's the contextual setting of all three of these practical need offices. And just as you had had to view giving as it pertained to your physical body, and view ruling as it pertained to your physical body, here also, even though it may sound weird, you have to view showing mercy as it pertains to your physical body. And I say that just so that we don't end up going down the wrong path in connection with this one, because we have a built-in problem with mercy, with showing mercy. And we could go down the wrong path and wind up lost in the woods, so to speak. And let me point out why. When you think about mercy, let's not even talk about the word showing right now, but think about mercy, or you talk to anybody about mercy, one of the most common ways, what is the number one most common way in which you think the word mercy is used in connection with what? Justice. That's right. In a legal sense. Like a judge, most often, most common, what first comes to mind when somebody says, show me mercy, they're in a position where they're about ready to receive some wrath. And mercy being some kind of a legal way, a legal out, or even the act of a judge to show what you might call leniency. The judge who shows mercy on a criminal grants him leniency. Leniency, by the way, is a synonym of mercy. But it's a synonym of mercy only in that legal sense. They were lenient. They went easy on me or whatever. All right, so what I want to do is I want to make sure that right before we begin dealing with this, that we don't go down that path. Because my understanding is that's not what showing mercy here is talking about. And I think we can prove that in several ways, not only with the context, but also when we talk about its functional, its description of functionality being showing mercy with cheerfulness. But let's for right now do that. Let's take that off the table and set that aside as a way of dealing with showing mercy, that we're not going to be showing mercy in the sense that somebody in the church deserves our wrath and then we're going to be lenient with them. So that doesn't really quite follow any body analogy anyway. But setting aside the definition of the term mercy in the legal sense, though it may seem odd to do this, you've got to think about this office, that first of all, showing mercy being an office, and think about it as it pertains to some practical needs that your physical body has. And by that, come up with some ways that you would operate according to showing mercy. This is one of the most beautiful ones in the entire body, by the way. And once that's done, then you have to perceive... You have to start thinking in terms of the grand design, as we talk about, and we'll do that for your godly sonship labor. And we're going to come up with the final component to this form of doctrine of edification. It means that we have to perceive how you showing mercy ministers to the body, ministers to the Lord, to His body here in this local assembly, which is now understood by you as one body in Christ, members one of another. And then once that's done, just simply perceive the overall operation of God that He wants accomplished by your laboring with Him in the office of showing mercy. Simple. right? It's easy. Well, before dealing with the definition of mercy as it pertains to our body, I want to take us to a couple of passages here that I just want to underscore the fact that the word mercy can be used by God and is used by God in more than just its legal justice type sense. It can be, in fact, used in an entirely different sense other than the judicial or legal sense of not pouring out wrath on an individual. Actually, you can let your eyes scan back up to verse 1 and you'll see one place where we noted that from Romans 12:1, when Paul besought us by the mercies of God. That didn't have anything to do with God not showing his wrath to us. But let's come over and just underscore this in a couple of other passages. Come back to the 37th Psalm. Come back to Psalm 37. All right. And this is a Psalm of David. And for time's sake here, we're not going to really delve into a lot of the context. I think I'll just take us down to the verse that we want to look at here. Psalm 37, come down to, a lot of this psalm has to do with the kind of wickedness that Israel's going to be experiencing and those kinds of things that are going to be happening to them here in the day of wrath, and especially in connection with the Lord functioning as their Redeemer to redeem them out of all of that. But come down to verse 21, what I'm after specifically. Verse 21, David writes, and this is a psalm of David. David says, "The wicked borroweth and payeth not again, but the righteous showeth mercy and giveth." Now, what you've got here is David setting up a contrast. And you have a contrast between the wicked and the righteous. And the wicked, well, we've all had this probably, he'll borrow and never pay you back. But the righteous, he shows mercy and he gives. Not only would he not take from you and not give back what he owed, but by showing mercy, he actively looks for opportunities to give to somebody in need. He's looking to fill a need. And that's his way of showing mercy. And that's all indicative and clues you in on the fact that there's ways of using the term mercy or showing mercy outside of simply withholding wrath from someone. One other passage in the Psalms. Come over to the 109th Psalm. Psalm 109. All the way over, you're now into the fifth book of the Psalms, where the Psalms now start looking out at the blesser and the blessings that Israel will enjoy out when the kingdom gets established. But let's come down here and just pick it up. Once again, a Psalm of David. And come down to, we could read several verses here, but let's just get a little bit of the, since it begins with the word because, let's at least get one verse ahead of that or back from that. Let's start at verse 15. David says, "Let them be before the Lord continually, that he may cut off the memory of them from the earth." You'd have to get back up in the context to find out who all of them are and what he's talking about. But he says in verse 16, "Because that he remembered not to show mercy, but persecuted the poor and needy man, that he might even slay the broken in heart." Now all I'm after there is especially verse 16, "Because that he remembered not to show mercy, but persecuted the poor and needy man." And really all we need right here is to see the contrast to showing mercy here is to persecute the poor and needy man. And therefore the opposite of that would be that you see someone in need or someone who is poor and you meet that need. This guy is not showing mercy. He remembered not to show mercy. Why? Because he persecuted the poor and needy man. So showing mercy would be to see that poor and needy man and meet that need, provide for them, And here's a very important word I'm about ready to use that hopefully will start generating some things going in your mind. Provide for that poor needy man to have relief from the predicament that he's in. And therefore, to relieve them, you show them mercy. Well, let's talk for a moment about that word, mercy. What does that mean? Again, not talking about it in terms of its judicial or legal sense. Showing mercy. What does mercy mean? That's good, yeah. Helping that person in their time of need, and more of an emphasis on the non-physical, but the other aspects that your body has. Anyone else?
Compassion.
I wondered when that word would come up. That's good. That's very good. Compassion. Because your body needs that. What? Okay. Relief. Yep. Anyone else? We're not fishing here. I'm not trying to get you to match my thoughts on anything. So I'm just, these are things you should have given some attention to and some thinking about mercy. And to me, this was the most difficult of all to deal with. Not so much mercy, but how does it fit into being a part of as an office that a member of my body would hold?
Provides peace.
Provides peace. Yeah, that's good. Anyone else?
I think of love when I think of
mercy. Yeah, it's one of the great ways in which love is put on display is by showing mercy. Although that can be enormously abused, because sometimes one of the most merciful things you could do to somebody would not necessarily be what would be considered by some the most loving thing to do.
Provide for a need and not expect for payment.
Yeah, to provide for a need without respect without expecting payment. Now, it's interesting how some of your answers are starting to blend a little bit with giving. And that's okay, because I knew that's why I was trying not to blur the lines, but to make it a little bit more clear than that. But that's okay.
Dealing with the
inner and the emotional rather than the outer and the physical. Those are all good. You're thinking you're going right down the right road and right path, and I don't have any problems with what you're talking about here. One of the things, like I said, that the way I was taught to think about mercy, whenever I see the word mercy and think of a definition of it, one of the things my pastor always taught us was that mercy, because mercy is so similar to whoever you're showing mercy to, being in a position where you now are showing favor to them or favor toward a particular body part or body member when you're talking about your physical body, sometimes even one who is in a position most undeserving, but yet you will still show mercy upon them. And in that way, mercy was always defined at, in where when I grew up as grace in action. That if you were to take the principles of grace and put grace into action, the result of that would be mercy. But I don't know if anybody mentioned the word forbearance. Luke mentioned compassion to another, not merely someone who deserves your wrath, but it could be anyone who is in need. But rather than turning a blind eye to the need a person has, you determine you can meet that need and therefore compassionately, and really what we're going to have is cheerfully, you meet that need. Mercy is oftentimes defined as compassionate treatment. Well, I don't think really any of us have any trouble understanding mercy here. What I really want to do is spend the rest of our time this morning trying to provoke your thinking into another area. When you take that understanding, just that general understanding, and that's really all you're expected to have right now, and you think about the actual physical members of your own body and what condition, what I want you to think about is not each other in this assembly. That's not where you're to start with these things. You're to start with your body, just you. And if you have a body part that you would look at and say, it's in a condition that mercy needs to... I've heard this expression come out of the mouth of women when they like have gone through what yesterday... Let's say you were running through downtown Raleigh in the middle of Irene and it was 30, 40 mile an hour and your hair had just been blown to smithereens, and you run into the salon, and the first thing out of your mouth, you look at your stylist, and you say, have mercy! All right? So there are parts of your body that need to be shown mercy. But what I'm after is that when you're thinking about a member of your body, what I want you to think about, not your hair, I probably got you thinking the wrong thing there, but what I want you to think about is what condition is one of your members in if you're going to show it mercy in that sense? It's weak, all right? That's almost there, but it's right down. Let's see if we can move that one little bit. Melanie said that you give it relief. If it's weak or in need of relief, what state is it in? It's hurting. It's what? Painful. It's tired. And if you were to take all of those words and put them under one word, how about they're suffering? Mercy is shown to someone who's suffering. Isn't the condition of one of your members of your body being in a state in that needs mercy, if it's tired, if it's in need of relief, if it's, what was your word, weak, it's in some state of suffering. One of the things that every single physical body experiences is its members suffer. So isn't showing mercy, therefore, in this sense, the gracious action toward those who suffer and are in trouble? You're going to provide relief. And I'm pushing us toward something here. If that sounds true and that rings true, and I'm persuaded it does, and we're going to run some passages on this in a moment, what I'm really going for here is you to get an understanding first and foremost. We're going to kind of skip over that second area all the way to the operation of God that stands behind this. And if all we can do is get to it today, then we'll run the verses in our next lesson. But if showing mercy is an office in which members of my body participate in toward other members of my body, other members that are suffering. I've seen people before, after walking and walking and walking, they sit down and, boy, they take their shoe off and their hands grab a hold of their foot and they begin massaging it. It's suffering. And it needs some relief. And that's what I want you to think about, because from that is going to emerge an operation that God has for your body and for this body of this local assembly. And this is one of the three, probably the least often used by your body, but it is one of the most powerful of them all, is showing mercy. So if we're following the steps along okay, and you're okay with that, that showing mercy is that forbearance and compassion toward one who is suffering, one who needs relief, who needs all those kinds of things. But the common denominator to all of that is that they're in a position of suffering. In other words, providing comfort, thoughtful concern. I almost hate to say what I'm about to say without you coming up with it. If you're talking about showing mercy to relieve suffering, relieve pain, provide comfort, what is your concern for the body? What? Welfare, well-being, all right? We're rolling, huh?
Continue to function normally.
Continue to function normally. We all took a class in this when we were in school. When you talk about the well-being of the whole body. What?
Health.
Health. Isn't that one of the four H's? I was never in 4-H, so I don't know. To me, it could have been hammer, helmet. I don't know what those 4-H's stood for exactly, but Cindy was. Showing mercy, providing compassionate comfort, has in view the thoughtful concern, doesn't it, for the health? Remember when Jesus healed the maniac, the lunatic, the one who was possessed and all of this kind of thing? And when he healed him, it says he was every whit whole. What he did for him wasn't just to relieve one immediate thing, but it brought about a bodily wholeness, holistic health. I'm going after something here that I think we're going to find dead on when it comes to, if that's true, if that's the kind of ministry that administers, that's kind of the level of how it ministers to the Lord's body. By the thoughtful concern for the health of the members of the body. But what would you say then would be what's the overall operation God wants to get accomplished by the office of showing mercy? What does he want to get accomplished for the whole body? That could be said that's a step beyond, or it's the overall general way of talking about that body's wholeness and well-being and health. That when you look at the body, you say it's this. When you look at an athlete that's ready to play, whether he's been on the disabled list, but now his members have been shown mercy, he's now rehabilitated, he's got relief, they've taken compassion on him by taking him out of the game and going through rehabilitation and getting the problem all solved and everything, and now when he's 100% and ready to go, you look at his whole body and you say he is now... No. Huh? No, not quite. Fit is a synonym. I my problem is knowing how to lead you to these things and ask you questions. It's a term that we use when we talk about mind and body. When you make out your will, you are of sound mind. He is sound. And folks, my understanding is that's exactly the operation of God behind mercy, is to give soundness to the body. And I'm going to show you how important that is in just a couple of minutes. It's soundness. If you went and you did some work with the word sound in the Scripture, as well as in a good dictionary and synonym dictionary, you'll find the words, every word you talked about, fitness and all of these kinds, the word soundness is a term that gathers all of those expressions up under its heading. The term that signifies a body. Listen, a body that is free from suffering, free from disease, free from worry, free from taint of any kind. You talk about it being of its sound. And all of those expressions, whether they're mental or whether they're physical, of being mentally, emotionally, spiritually whole. Whole of mind, wholeness of body, is sound. And God uses that expression that way. We don't have time to do it right now, but we're going to run a number of passages on that. You're here in the book of Psalms. Let's just look at one of them. Come over to the 38th Psalm. And I'm not going to go through all of these because I want to take some time on this so that you can see how surrounding the context of these expressions has been some act of merciful compassion, some act in which something has transpired that brings about the need that when you look at that body and you want to remark or make a remark or make a comment about its wholeness and about its fitness and about its completeness and all of these, or its being free from disease or free from suffering or taint of any kind, this word that is God uses to employ that is this word sound. Look at verse 1 of the 38th Psalm. And this once again is a Psalm of David. And we're going to read through a little bit of this, and this is why I want to spend time on this, because I don't want it to go away. This is such a powerful thing. David writes here in the 38th Psalm, O Lord, rebuke me not in thy wrath, neither chasten me in thy hot displeasure. For thine arrows stick fast in me, and thy hand presseth me sore. There is no soundness in my flesh because of thine anger. Neither is there any rest in my bones because of my sin. For mine iniquities are gone over mine head. As an heavy burden, they are too heavy for me. My wounds stink and are corrupt because of my foolishness. I am troubled. I am bowed down greatly. I go mourning all the day long. For my loins are filled with a lonesome disease, and there is no soundness in my flesh. Now what you have David describe there, every time he wants to describe himself, whether it's his spiritual condition or the mental, soulish anguish that comes from that condition of being in a position where he deserves the wrath of God. And we're not talking about showing mercy in the sense of God holding his wrath back, but rather this context so well points up that when you're either in spiritual, emotional, or even physical suffering, the best way to describe the overallness, I don't think that's a word, but the overallness of what your body condition is, David says there is no soundness in it. And folks, that's the exact opposite of what mercy in the body is designed to produce. It's designed to produce and to give that body, I don't care if it's a body of 4 or 5 that meet in a home, or 4 or 50 or 60 that meet in a local church, that local assembly and that body is to have soundness to it. And that soundness is the operation that is achieved when mercy is being shown cheerfully by the members of the body. And this isn't so much a passage that teaches what all that is as it is to point up what it is to not be in soundness of body. And David runs the gamut of everything here. That when he is before God, worthy of God's wrath, and how God sees him as a sinful creature in his sight, when he describes all of the suffering and the ramifications of being in that position, whether it's mental, spiritual, physical, you have it in verse 3, there is no soundness in my flesh. You have it in verse 7, for my loins are filled with loathsome disease. There is no soundness in my flesh. And that shows you in a great contrasting opposite feature of what the opposite of soundness is. Soundness being that it is free from, it's been relieved of all of that suffering. It's been relieved of all of the disease, all of the anything that would taint it. And this is one of the most important operations of our Father in a local assembly. And folks, this can be done, listen, before you ever think another thought about it, this can be done without violating anybody's privacy. We're not talking about being busybodies and poking your nose in areas where it doesn't belong or anything along those lines. But I will tell you what it does demand in this local assembly, and that is some communication going on. To be able to find out how you really are doing. And one of the most primary things where this assembly is concerned, how are you doing with this doctrine? Is it effectually working? Are you having problems with it? But this is a very compelling and powerful office to get involved with. And we end at a bad time today, but we're going to have to because I'd spent a lot of time on the next few. We're going to run 1, 2, 3, at least 3, and maybe 4 other passages on this, one of which... this issue of soundness occurs in the parable of the prodigal son. Well, showing mercy is the thoughtful concern for the comfort, the health, the soundness of the members of its body. And therefore, it factors into a very powerful overall operation of God and to the aspect of how it administers to the body, how it ministers to the Lord in that supportive, gracious action function that we have. Well, we're going to stop right there with it right now, kind of leave it hanging a little bit, but we're going to look at some passages in Isaiah, in Luke, and in Acts. There's a fantastic passage that Peter goes into in Acts in which this issue of soundness is brought out and how God deals with it, and what lies behind that is any issue that you have a suffering problem that occurs in which there's not a wholeness to that to a body. It's a great body term that has to do with God's operation behind those offices that deal with showing mercy. Well, we'll stop right there, and we'll pick this up in our next lesson.